This is the March 11 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Merrill Crowley of First Choice Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois, Aaron Curtis from Midco in Bloomington, Jackie Vakes from Total Farm Marketing is here as well. She's from Hollister, Missouri. Our special guest for the day is John Newton. He's the Chief Economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. That's AFBF out of Washington, D.C. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to us online anytime you'd like. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. We'll introduce John a bit more in a second, but Merrill, Aaron, and Jackie, I'd like a list of items that you might want to discuss for the day. Merrill, I think we'll start with you, please.
Planning intentions. That's probably the main thing on my mind right now.
Sure. Aaron Curtis?
Yeah, another supply-demand report in the books and no changes to speak of. That marks really the second one in a row we've seen like that. Does anybody really expect much changes in the supply-demand balance sheet here as we move through the rest of the spring?
And Jackie Vakes.
Well, I'd like to address phase one and where we are on the exports and the impact we're seeing or you're anticipating seeing because of these vessels that are refusing to take exports from the U.S. ports, the bean issues that are going on down in Brazil. And John, you still work with milk, right? So class three, I'd like to just ask a quick question about class three milk.
All right, well, we'll get right to that. John Newton, thank you for being with us, by the way. Chief Economist at AFBF in Washington, D.C. I bet you have just been busy there with a new administration trying to get things in order with the Farm Bureau. What was top priority for Zippy Duvall and company there?
Well, we've already been through two hearings, actually three, if you consider Arizona Farm Bureau. Stephanie Smallhouse was at a hearing today on climate issues. My boss was at a hearing, I guess, last week or the week before. At this point, it all kind of rolls together on climate issues. And then we had another hearing with Chairman Scott on the House Ag Committee and G.T. Thompson there on food insecurity today. So we've been very busy. We've been very busy with USDA, engaging with all the new faces there and engaging with all the members on Congress, just sharing the priorities of farmers and ranchers. We've been engaged through the confirmation processes. We've already had conversations with the secretary. So there's a lot of needs right now in agriculture and rural America, and we're trying to make sure that we communicate all those priorities to our new leaders on Capitol Hill and at the White House.
I should have mentioned that Zippy Duvall, of course, is the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Jackie Vakes, I know you started in on a question with John, but why don't you repeat the phase one question, what you'd like to know from him?
Well, I'd like to know, John, how we're doing as far as the second year of phase one, and then an interrelated question being the impact of these vessel operating common carriers who are refusing to take exports from the United States ports and what impact that might have.
So on the phase one agreement, I think when you look at where we were last year, $27.2 billion in terms of agricultural exports to China on the phase one tariff lines, that was a record. And then when you look at the structural changes, 51 out of 57 structural changes have been met by the Chinese. If anybody would have told us, in March that we'd export a record amount of products to China and we'd get 51 out of 57 structural changes, I think people would have been very happy with that outcome. Where we are now in January, the seasonal slowdown in exports has occurred. We shipped about $3.8 billion to China in January. The goal for phase one, year two, is around $40.4 billion worth of exports to China. So obviously all eyes are going to be on that. Each month when we get the new data from the Census Bureau. And then in terms of the container issue, we've been very engaged on that. I think especially for a lot of our agricultural products that come out of the West Coast, our dairy, our meat products, hay, your fruits and vegetables, your tree nuts, it's a pretty big issue. And you know, some of the big exporters have space, but some of our smaller producers are finding it real hard to get access to space on a vessel for their export products. So, you know, we're working on that. But if you think about it, USDA is projecting fiscal year 21 exports at nearly $160 billion. That's going to be a record. But in order to do that, we've got to be able to get our products on those vessels and off of our shore. So I think that's a headwind right now currently.
So Pat Wolf from AFBF was on the radio as just a soundbite on Thursday afternoon's closing market report. She's with AFBF and was discussing this issue. It's related to containers, and I think their availability, and then there's just not enough space in the port, and it's about COVID. Are there things that can happen or that the administration can do to help straighten this supply chain out?
Well, you know, there's obviously a worker issue. So workers in the port to get the vessels unloaded. There's vessels that are waiting to get in the port to be unloaded. And then what are folks doing right now? You know, they're sitting at home. They're buying trinkets. They're not out at restaurants spending their disposable income. So the demand for these containers to get back to China, fill them up with goods, and bring it back is pretty significant. And that's why some of them are just loading those empty vessels, empty cargo containers back on those vessels to get them back over to China, because there's more money to get those goods back to the United States. You know, we were a service-based economy pre-COVID, and now, you know, COVID's taken a lot of those services off the table, and we're buying a lot more goods, and I think that's impacting the availability of containers here, Todd.
So this is the opposite of the problem that we had before, which was relatively speaking, because we were able to fill as many for backhaul cheaply as possible, and today they just want those back as soon as possible, and they can't wait to load them up with some other good, I guess.
Yeah, and I read quite a bit of, up on it too. And one of the things they said that was a big problem is that in order to unload our goods, our grains and that type of thing, they have to go inland, and it just takes a whole lot more time. So they just don't want to waste the time. They can make more money just by doing the turnaround and even going back empty than they can going inland and unloading.
Merrill Crowley, do you have a question for John?
John, Farm Bureau put together a farmer-led working group that spent about 4 months looking at NASA's process and methodologies. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about what recommendations they may have, and then as a second question, how those recommendations may be being received by the USDA?
Well, we've got an excellent relationship with NAS. I mean, Hubert Hamer and myself, the administrator of NAS, we're, you know, talk to him very frequently. I talk to Joe Parsons at NAS and Dan at NAS, Lance at NAS. We speak very frequently, and we let them know very early on about our working group. They were the first people that our working group actually sat and talked to. And in terms of, you know, some of the recommendations, you know, it's really about making sure that they've got the latest and greatest technology, resources, expertise available to them to take the information that the growers provide and give it back to folks as accurately and as timely as possible. And they're receptive to it. And I think one of the things that in talking with Illinois Farm Bureau or Iowa Farm Bureaus, you know, our I states, I think there's interest in the Farm Bureau community to, you know, when they open Capitol Hill back up, is to work some shoe leather and get NAS some more resources so they can do even more. And I think, you know, Farm Bureau is going to be a partner in trying to help NAS. And I think that'll go a long way, you know, to improving farmer confidence in our statistical arm. I mean, we're so lucky to have a NAS. There are countries out there that don't have anything like what we have through NAS and the World Board and ERS. So it is the gold standard, and we need to make sure that they've got all the resources they need to be even better.
Have you identified any problem areas? For instance, is it that they're not getting data back from the questionnaires? Is the data somehow not as good as it should be? What kinds of things have you or been looking at or have you identified as problems?
Well, I think it's no secret that farmer participation in the surveys has slowed. I mean, when I was there at U of I, there was a big effort, a big push to get farmers to complete these surveys because, hey, guess what? Now all of a sudden your farm bill programs depend on the information in those surveys. And unfortunately, because the information in the survey response rate was so low, we ultimately shifted to using crop insurance data to administer the R County program in 2018. So, certainly there's an opportunity to increase survey response rate, but there's also, an ability to make it less burdensome. If you can do TurboTax in a couple minutes, you should be able to do your NAS work in a couple minutes. They've got a lot of your data already with FSA or RMA. Is there a way to cross-pollinate the information that we're sending the various USDA agencies so that we can take the burden off the producer in completing these surveys? And I think the other thing, if we can make it timelier, if we can improve their technology and how they collect information from us, we might be able to increase the frequency of reports. I mean, think about if we could have had a better handle on the impact of the derecho on crop yields, not a month, not 2 months, not 3 months later, but within a matter of weeks. Private companies can do it. We should have the statistical arm of the U.S. government able to do the same thing.
What are they missing that they can't pull that off?
Well, I mean, it's resources. It's, I think they need, more money. They need access to supercomputers to run the algorithms. They need staff that knows how to utilize that technology. There needs to be upward mobility for those staff. I mean, so there are a lot of challenges. I mean, to keep and retain top talent is difficult, Todd, and that's, that's across all of government, not just NAS.
Let's get one more question for you, and then we'll move on. Aaron Curtis, do you have a question?
I do. Kind of a two-part question, John, kind of going back to China a little bit. Just first off, China and U.S. expected to meet next week in Alaska. Do you expect anything regarding ag to come out of that meeting? Then the second part of that is, as we move forward specifically to ag trade, do you see any stark differences in the Biden administration's approach to China versus the previous administration?
So, I think this is one of those things where we're going to have to just sit back and watch, how things unfold. We don't have a lot of information on, how this the Biden White House is what their posture is going to be towards China. They've talked about, being tough on China. They talked about, taking more of a multilateral approach to discuss China. So, this is something that we're going to have to watch. But what we do know is that, it's a big market for U.S. agriculture. They're projected to be our top export market in fiscal year 2021. So we want to make sure that the gains that we've seen through the Phase One agreement remain. And then look forward to communicating the priorities of agriculture, not just on the Phase One, because we need to feed, there are people around the world, there are markets around the world that we need better access to, fair access to. And I know many people have talked about in recent months, hey, take a look over here at that TPP that we were, about to join 4 years ago. That might be a good place to start. But I think that the Biden White House has made it pretty clear they want to focus on domestic issues. That's a priority. We need to get past the coronavirus. I think there's likely to be a pretty big infrastructure package coming, sometime this year. Hopefully, we can find a way to do that in a bipartisan way. But domestic issues are certainly going to be a priority. And then finally, we saw in the American Rescue Plan, we saw in the December COVID package that was done bipartisanly that there's going to be more resources to address food insecurity here in the United States. And President Duvall was at a hearing today with Chairman Scott and Chairman Thompson on the House side addressing that issue. We've seen SNAP benefits expand by nearly 60%. We've seen more resources dedicated to addressing food insecurity here in the United States, and there was nearly $4 billion in the American Rescue Plan to purchase and distribute agricultural and food products through not just your traditional nonprofits, but restaurants and other food distribution networks. So, I think that's a domestic demand pool, and then we, obviously we're going to continue to focus on the export market too.
Transitioning now, Aaron Curtis, to the marketplace this week. The United States Department of Agriculture updated the supply and demand tables. Those come out each and every month for corn and soybeans and wheat. There were so few changes that it actually didn't change the bottom line on any of them. You made note that this is the second one in a row that has been very blasé. Are they locked in now, do you suppose?
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to kind of watch the market reaction. We chopped around on both report days, both February and March, and then we saw some pretty heavy liquidation on both day after reports, both in February and March. And then obviously since the February report up through the March report kind of firmed up a little bit again, and we'll see what happens after this one. But I think the export numbers are the ones that's probably continuing to maybe have some question marks by it, because when you look at the sales pace to date, we sold another 12 million beans here this morning in the export report. We only need to average a little over 1 million a week, so we can't necessarily afford a whole lot more sales moving forward. The same with corn, sold 15 million on Thursday morning this week, and only need to average a little over 10. So I think there's some question, right, if those export numbers are still a little too low. But I think we'll see as we get a little further into hopefully April and May, we'll see a little bit of adjustment up than that. I think the question here moving forward, right, is export demand has slowed. Argentina priced cheaper than the U.S. on corn. Brazil priced cheaper than the U.S. on soybeans. So, we're kind of going to this period where we see export demand continue to slow, and that, probably is going to keep futures a little bit in check, at least in the short term here, Todd. So I think the USDA continues to say a wait-and-see approach, and I would assume as we move into April, it may be more of the same here, waiting to see, especially on corn, if more of this corn actually does ship, because we still need to average, almost 60 million bushels of corn a week to meet the USDA goal. That's a pretty aggressive pace, and we'll continue to see if that gets met.
John, I'll come to you because I want to stay kind of with old crop, but look forward into the grain stocks figures at the end of the month. They'll come out on the same day as the prospective plantings numbers. Are we expecting big usage this time around?
Well, I think when you look at the livestock sector, it's certainly recovering from a pretty tough spring. I think we still see the ethanol industry facing some challenges. And I think the export story is important. We've got a lot of bushels that have yet to ship. So we're going to need to pay attention to that. But I agree. I think the markets have kind of cooled off a little bit. They're waiting for some new headlines to chew on. And I don't think we're going to get that until the March report. And then all eyes are going to be on plant. Guys are anxious to get out. I was just talking to a farmer who's getting ready to get out in the field pretty soon. We're anxious to get a crop in the ground. Then all eyes are going to be on the weather, I think. And we've seen in recent years how the weather can really drive prices.
Well, Jackie, looking forward to that prospective plantings report at the end of the month, which is based on a survey of some 80,000 producers across the nation. Are they likely to tell USDA that they're going to put more acres in the grounds of all kinds of crops than not?
Well, my experience has been that when the March report comes out, it usually follows pretty close to where we have been. I think we learned back when corn prices went so high the last time, we saw a tremendous surge in corn acres, and we also saw a loss in price. And so I think that this is not going to be any different, Todd, than any other year, from the standpoint that if we get an early spring, we get going, we'll probably plant more corn. If we have a delayed spring, we're going to plant more beans. And at the moment, I've been hearing from guys who haven't planted beans in a long time that they're saying that they're going to plant beans this year. Now, whether they follow through and do that, that's another question. you know, we really don't know. But, you know, when I look at the prospective plantings, my biggest concern isn't that report. It's the grain stocks report. That's the report that, to me, is at the heart of everything. And that grain stocks report, we know as long as the commercial controls the majority of the grain, which they do, your downside is not nearly as severe as it would be if the farmer were sitting on all of it. And so that's a position that we're in with old crop. So I think that you're very right when anybody says, we're just waiting for more news. You know, you got to feed the bull. And right at the moment, there hasn't been much feed around, and the USDA report didn't give us anything either.
So you think the grain stocks report will show fewer bushels on hand than expected?
Well, when you look at the numbers on it, three out of the last 3 years for beans, it was lower than what we thought it was going to be. Two out of the last 5 years, we were lower than the corn, and actually two out of the last 2 years, and three out of the last 5 years, we've been lower than that. So, you know, I guess it's a tough one to guess in that respect. But we do know, you know, that it's being used rapidly. Now, one of the things we also know is that out in the countryside, you know, cash takes care of a lot of things. And so from having been a nutrition consultant for all those years, when prices start doing what they're doing right now, and unfortunately, we had a lot of end users that hadn't covered themselves, there are alternative products you can use. And so, you know, this is very much a demand-driven rally that we've got going on here. And to me, we've just totally slipped past probably one of the biggest things in the room, and that is what's happening down in South America. And if their bean crop is severely damaged by the water, which we're seeing in Mato Grosso, that also has a big impact on what's going to happen. But, you know, information coming out of there is slow, and adjustments to their numbers are slow. We just saw them, the USDA just raised their number. So how long will it take before it goes back down until they get some confirmation? So it's going to be interesting. I love that report. I think it's going to be, it makes for a heartstopper sometimes.
Well, Merrill Crowley, this report is due out on March the 31st, and we'll get both of them, the grain stocks and the prospective plantings numbers. You wanted to talk a little bit about what those acreage figures might look like. USDA's Ag Forum pegged them at 92 million for corn and 90 million for soybeans. How close are those numbers, and have they changed very much since then?
Well, whether they change or not, you know, everybody gets a guess. In some of the information I was looking at, we've got looking at maybe 5 for prevent plant, 5 million, 21 for CRP, and then 136 for other crops. And I think about the only one right now that could have maybe taken some acres away would have been cotton, maybe sorghum. But anyway, so if you put those together, you come up with, I missed my notes. 344 million acres, basically, if you add 182 for corn and soybeans into that. Okay, how does that compare? 2014 total planted acres were 346.7. 2008 and 2010 total planted acres were 350 million. So that leaves about another 2.7 for either corn or beans as compared to 2014, or another 6 million acres when compared to 2008 and 2010. Dividing that equally between corn and soybeans, we could have somewhere in the neighborhood of 95 and 93 million respectively. And as Jackie says, you know, if the weather's nice, they tend to want to plant corn more than they do beans. Currently, I don't see much change in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio. However, I am wondering what the Iowa farmers may want to do, especially after the poor corn-on-corn performance that they have and some of the drier weather. Looking at the wheat acres, I'm looking right now, and it might be too large, it might have to be worked down, but 10 to 15% winter kill for another 3 to 5 million lost acres in wheat that could go either to corn or beans. So everyone gets a guess. I think there's room for working higher. You know, and then the other thing is a lot of nitrogen, a lot of fertilizer is already on. The February insurance average suggests a ratio of corn-soybean ratio of 2.59, and today's board price, 2.57, it suggests more beans. like I said, there's usually not much change in the I states and the Illinois the Corn Belt. But it was interesting that the Ayler brothers were planting soybeans on WCIA yesterday. So with some of this coming, this beans planted early, some of the problems with corn on corn, the acres probably coming from wheat, I'm wondering if some of that's going to be the historical norm of how acres work could be challenged this year.
Hey, does anyone think in the derecho area, and is it big enough and large enough to sway? I suppose because it's in Iowa and they tend to have more corn after corn, that there could be a larger switch to soybean acres there in order to control rogue corn in this year after such a rough storm that put so much of it on the ground last fall. And is that enough acreage to make a difference? I don't know, John, what have you been hearing about Iowa?
Well, most of the work that I've been doing on Iowa, and you know, with Iowa Farm Bureau and talking to them is we need to get help for the derecho. We need to get disaster assistance, WIP plus payments to help some of those farmers. We had 700,000 acres unharvested in Iowa last year. The average is around 300,000. So there's a lot of stuff laying on the ground or at 45-degree angles and difficult to get it out of the field. So that's certainly something that we've been working on. I think there'll be an opportunity to hopefully do something soon for the derecho as well as some of the dry conditions we've seen out in Texas as well. But in terms of you know, whether more guys are going to go soybeans and corn, I haven't really had many folks reaching out at this point. So I can't really provide much color to you there, Todd.
Time to get a little poll question in. What do each of you, as the commodity analyst, believe farmers should be doing about old crop sales yet for corn?
The majority of people that I talk with are basically sitting on what they call gambling stocks. A lot of them rewarded the market on the way up. And so I think in general, depending upon where it is, if it's sitting at the elevator or if it's sitting at home, I think there's still opportunity for a move higher. And so perhaps the answer would be buy yourself a call so you have the guts to make the sale, you know, because unfortunately that's the problem that we run into all the time. You know, we put a goal out there, we say we're going to make the sale, and then we don't do it because we're afraid it's going to go higher. And so do I think that we could see old crop demand continue to be strong? Yes. And then again, I'm going to say though, we keep hearing about African swine fever in China. It's not that widespread or anything else, but like John said, you know, we've seen everything slow down. We know that corn export inspections are at 84% already for the year. Those things are all sitting in the background. But at the moment, I think when you look at the black box trading, just in general and how strong things have been, I'd like to see you get rid of it and just buy a call, to be honest with you. But that's a pretty hard sell to a lot of guys. So if they don't want to do that, they've got to be ready to pull the trigger. There's just no two ways about it.
Merrill Crowley?
I'm looking at the supports. And if we break the supports, I think we probably need to get something done. If the grain is in your storage facilities, I guess I would ask the guys to look for a hedge-to-arrive type contract and try to capture basis either during planting season or as we move in the summer where basis normally gets better. And that supports 530 May corn. I've got 474.5 to 465 D's corn, 1378, 1335 May soybeans, 1230 and 1203 no beans. And if I just think if we break that resistance, it suggests prices could go lower. We're at somewhat of a conundrum with the meal prices breaking through the bottom of a descending triangle yesterday. They did not recover any today. The old adage, and I'm kind of watching this, and I think you and Kurt and Wayne and I were talking about this a while back, what happens if they come after the oil for, blending with diesel? and how much it would take to meet the USDA's quotas that they wanted to meet. And in a sense, that seems like what's happening right now. You know, but the meal part of that structure is actually declining. We've seen oil rally about 130%. We've seen meal rally about 80%, I think. But the meal has been on the short end of those rallies. So I guess what I'm looking at is follow those supports. I do think it's possible to see a drop lower, even lower than where we're at now. It's looking more and more like a sideways move. I don't think this market's at a point where it can just completely give up, like, say, from a high level down clear into fall yet. We have too many weather issues, too many supply issues to close out. So it just looks to me like I would look at those support levels, because if they get broke, it suggests possibly a double move lower, and then use hedge-derived contracts and set your basis at a later date.
John, I want to come to you in just a minute, but to give you a heads up, I'd like you to give me some information, if there is some floating around Washington, D.C. on renewable diesel and the potential demand for soybean and other oil products, corn oil in particular in my mind. But I will move to Aaron Curtis, and rather than asking you about what farmers should do, I want to know, have farmers put sell orders in for old crop corn and soybeans?
Well, there's very little percentage-wise, especially for this time of year, really left, Todd. We estimate the farmers sold 85 to 90% of old crop beans and, you know, 75 to 80% of old crop corn. So the remaining bushels that are left are in fairly tight hands, I would say. And I think it's more of a timing issue at this point. I think it's going to be waiting and seeing what kind of start we have to the crop in the U.S. Planting. And I think we start knocking off the time period, you know, emergence, pollination, and those kind of things before the farmer really, you know, gets much more aggressive at this point. Our, you know, the buying that we've seen from the farmer in the last month has slowed considerably, Todd. And I expect it to continue to be on the slow side unless, A, you know, we do rally into those old highs on corn, which is up around 575-ish. We may see a little interest there, but I think it's more of a timing now. It's a little bit of an insurance, right, against any sort of U.S. Weather problem here with, you know, you could make the case that there's very little weather premium from the U.S. built into these markets at this point.
Speaking of insurance and looking forward into the new crop, have they been making new crop sales for that which won't be covered by crop insurance?
I think overall that the farmers, you know, roughly 10 to 15% on sold on new crop corn and soybeans. And I think, you know, $5 mark on these corn would get some interest again. And, you know, that $12.50 area on November beans got some interest. So we probably need to go incrementally higher again on that to get another round going. But I think as we get into the planting season, crop gets off to a decent start. If it does, then I think we'll see the farmer a little more engaged. But new crop selling has slowed as well, as this market has kind of, you know, flattened out. We're just not seeing the big volatility moves that we saw, you know, in that D's through January timeframe.
We'll get a final statement from everybody just in a moment, but I would like to hear, John, if you have any insight on the renewable diesel issue and what that might mean for the agricultural community.
You know, I think that, you know, our perspective on these issues, and we've already visited with EPA's new Administrator Regan on the importance of the renewable fuel standard, and quite frankly, the conversation that we've had, and one that we haven't had on this show right now, Todd, is this administration's climate agenda and what they want to do to address, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and how they want to capture more carbon in the soil and things of that nature. And our communication was renewable fuels are a key component of that. And so we want to make sure that we protect the RFS and make sure that, you know, that market's part of the solution. And then let's also talk about all of our other ways that we can adopt climate smart practices across the country, find voluntary incentive-based tools to do so.
Let's get a final word now from our regular panelist. We'll start with you, Jackie Vakes of Total Farm Marketing.
Well, this certainly has been a difficult year, and in more ways than one. I think that so many people got caught because everything was so negative. Now suddenly everything is so positive, and therefore it's easy to get emotionally tangled up. What you really need to do is you need to look at your bottom line, where you're making money, and make your decisions based on that.
Aaron Curtis from Midco.
While the market has been a little quieter recently, I think we're far from seeing the volatility. And I think that March 31st crop report for both acres and stocks is going to renew the vigor. We've got spec limits increasing next week at the CME. So continue to watch that as well. But I would continue to suggest if you've got offers that you want to put in place, have them working, because we see a lot of volatility in the overnight session, while everybody's hopefully resting. So, you know, have those offers in place on targets that you want to price some either old crop or new crop, because, you know, there's a lot of interesting things happen in the overnight session.
And Merrill Crowley.
In a conversation with a crop insurance agent, he had a client with 190 APH that bought 95% insurance coverage. The cost for that was, I think, $50 an acre. And the insurance agent remarked that if he doesn't price it, it would be like buying calls and not selling crop. And I looked today on the close with closing prices, took a 30-cent basis off of corn and beans. 180 bushel per acre corn would gross $815.40. 50 bushel beans would gross $606.50. And I guess along the lines to what Jackie was saying, I don't necessarily say the market won't go higher. What I am suggesting is you analyze your risk and make plans based on your farm numbers. We get too emotionally caught up with some of these high prices we've been told of in the last few days. There's a lot of things that need to fall into place in order for those type of prices to materialize. Protect your bottom line.
John Newton from AFBF, any final word from you?
You know, I think what everybody's talking about is spot on. I think marketing needs to be a key component. I think when we talked about being afraid to sell at the prices because you think they're going higher, you know, things can change in a hurry. And there's no better example of how quickly things can change than what we've seen the last 7 months or so in the markets. I mean, who would have thought last spring when we were in the throes of the coronavirus that we'd be talking about beans in the teens as a reality? So I think you have to prepare for the unexpected. You have to take in consideration risk and manage that risk. I think we look at African swine fever. Could it get worse? Could that impact demand? It certainly could. So, you know, take all those factors into consideration, manage your risk, be a good marketer. Don't use those bushels as walking around or gambling money. I think marketing's the way to go.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like. You can do that on our website at willag.org, willag.org. We'd like to thank our panelists for the week. They include Jackie Vakes of Total Farm Marketing, Merrill Crowley of First Choice Commodities, and Aaron Curtis of Midco, along with our special guest this week, John Newton, the Chief Economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.